Okay, everybody, welcome to the podcast this week. Honored, and I don't use that word lightly, to have Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm here with him at his office at the Hayden Planetarium across the street from my old apartment that I lived in and owned in my previous life as a lawyer and an investment banker, and then I had to sell it to be a comedian. But
it's so they kicked you out. Yeah, it wasn't. It was different.
It wasn't meant to be. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm shaking your hand on the podcast.
Sure, sure.
I just wanted to jump in right here, and one of the things that struck me, I was noticing.
Wait, you're an ex-lawyer.
Yeah, lawyer okay. And investment banker.
Okay, thanks for warning me up front. So I'll temper my lawyer comments.
No, I'm out of the business.
You're out of the business.
I went to,
my favorite lawyer joke of them all was told to me by a lawyer.
Yeah, what is it?
Yeah, he said, it's the 2% of lawyers that give, no, what is it? It's the 98% of lawyers that give the other 2% a bad name.
Well, it was sort of like I was doing M&A deals on Wall Street. You know, I went to Georgetown Law and I ended up in New York.
M&A, mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah.
Not MMA, which would be mixed martial arts.
I was kicking some serious ass with other lawyers. They're not that tough.
You know? Right. Yeah, apparently. Right. They'll just sue you.
Yeah.
Right. They don't know how to punch. They just know how to sue.
Well, you would appreciate the physics of this. They have suspenders on. So you get leverage with them if you grab the suspenders and wrap it around.
Yeah, provided they're not clipped on, because then the clip just pops off.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. See, ever the scientist, you go that extra layer.
No, it means I've thought about tossing people with their suspenders.
There's a commonality, though, in scientists.
Well, you know the best suspenders to toss them with? If they have overalls on. It connects straight to the groin, you know? You just grab it.
Well, you were a wrestler. So
yeah, I used to wrestle, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And a Latin dancer.
That was another chapter of my life as well.
I would give $1 million.
No.
To see you. And you toyed with the idea, and I don't know if this is true, of sort of working as an exotic dancer to make extra money when you were young.
Yeah, I was really short on money in graduate school.
Yeah, but that's got to be really, really short to think about that.
It was. No, I was desperate. Desperately short
University
on money.
University of Texas in Austin?
Yeah. And I was on, I danced with the performing company back when I was in dance shape.
Yes.
Some of my fellow dancers, the 40 pounds ago.
Well, I checked you out.
No, 40 pounds ago. And so back then, my fellow dancers were dancing in these exotic clubs for women. And they heard my financial woes. And they said, why don't you come check it out? Maybe, we can bring you in as one of the dancers. Mm. And that's when I checked it out. And it was like, no.
Why?
Well, because the dance that I happened to see, they came out with asbestos-lined jock straps that had been soaked in lighter fluid and then ignited, and they came out dancing to Jerry Lee Lewis's Great Balls of Fire. So I said, nope. And at that moment, I said, I should be a math tutor. And of course, I'm embarrassed that I didn't think of that first, because of course I can tutor mathematics.
Right.
And I mean, graduate school, and they're undergraduates who need math tutoring. So.
And you could do it in a thong if you wanted to.
So the math... I'm embarrassed because that was such a clear decision in my head, watching their genitals on fire at that moment. But so
was it too literal? Maybe the dance, you know, the great balls of fire, the balls on fire. Like, you know,
it wouldn't
maybe
have
that
mattered
position.
What they
you're
danced
an artist.
To.
You're.
It would not have mattered what they danced to. I'm pretty sure I would have landed on mathematics. And so I majored. I tutored in math. It was like, I don't know, $6 an hour or something.
Right.
But it was enough to just to soften the edges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's an interesting... So, yes, I was a lawyer and all of that. And then I left to be a comedian when I sold a couple of jokes to Jay Leno on a lark. I just was writing jokes as a hobby and he did them on The Tonight Show. And
is that how that works? You sell jokes? They're really...
Well,
it's like a stock exchange of jokes?
Yeah, there's a market. Actually, no. You have a long trench coat and you're standing in a
and you open it up.
Hey, psst. I got lawyer jokes. I got hooker jokes. No, I was writing.
Oh, but you have science jokes. That's a whole other category. And thought about that.
One of the things he did.
That's low hanging fruit, right?
Yeah,
there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You are the funniest scientist I've ever seen.
No, I think the universe is fundamentally hilarious. So I'm just revealing that fact.
Well, we're going to get to this in a minute. But if I had you as a science teacher, as opposed to the old cranky guy who smoked Pall Mall filterless cigarettes in the classroom and was happy.
In the day. Are you that old?
I went to public high school in Rhode Island, and it wasn't great. Let's put it that way. And which sort of, I want to get to that in a second, but there's
issues.
Well, yeah, my mother was in the school department in Rhode Island. She was on the school committee, and then she served under Buddy Cianci, who was our crooked mayor in Providence, who slapped around a guy for cheating on his wife with him himself, put a cigarette out on the guy, and then was convicted, went to jail, and they got reelected by a landslide. And when they asked this old Italian woman why she voted for him, she said, "Hey, the guy was messing around with his wife. He deserved what he got." And so that's sort of the Italian way. So yeah, I mean, public school was school, you mm-hmm. know, and I know for you, there's some issues there. I mean, but there's a quote that I read about you from Joe Patterson, a professor of astronomy at Columbia University.
So you did some homework before this interview.
I've got, look.
Oh my God, what do you got there?
I got, look. I got one, and I got
let the record show.
I've got 17.
The man pages. Did his homework. Okay.
I'm an anal lawyer. That's what okay. I was saying. Lawyers mm-hmm. and scientists, I think, on some level, have to be anal, don't you?
Well, just to be fair to the word anal.
Mm. Yeah.
No, you can be anal retentive or anal expulsive. These are two opposites.
See, right now you're being anal right now.
I'm just letting you know. So you have to actually specify which of these anals you are.
Okay.
So generally, when people say anal, they in almost every case mean anal retentive.
Yes.
Right. And but technically, anal could branch to either.
Yes.
To either of those.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you ever like?
Just FYI.
Are you ever so precise that you annoy people?
I try to walk that
I'm
line.
Not saying you're not. You're annoying.
Yeah. That's a hint.
No.
We only just started the podcast.
No, I know exactly. No, because my wife, who's fascinated by you as well, she works in museums herself as a curator of historic costumes and clothing.
Cool. Which museum is that?
Brooklyn Museum, Queens Museum.
Nice.
She
nice.
Some work here.
Love it.
Society Preservation.
Love it.
She has her master's from the Cooper Hewitt, and mm-hmm. she merged her love of clothing and history.
Nice.
And she said to tell you that, so I did. So
okay,
it's on
good.
The record. But she said, there's so many questions I want to ask him. And then she wondered, what are the things that you sort of are asking yourself right now or questions that you have? And I got to believe there's a myriad of them that you're sort of grappling with right now or toying with. Because for someone like you, I would imagine the list is endless.
Yeah. But so as a scientist or as any professional research person,
yeah.
you spend your life, you spend your time in school hacking your way, not hacking in a computer sense, hacking as someone who would
hack through jungle,
mm-hmm. Through thorn and thistle. and you finally get to the boundary between what is known and unknown in the universe or in your field.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you pitch tent as mm-hmm. a research scientist. So looking out in one direction, you know the content of your field that you have mastered.
Mm-hmm.
You look 180 degrees opposite from that, and it's everything that you know nothing about.
And is that daunting on some level?
If it were, you'd never become a scientist. Yeah. I think to the people for whom that's daunting, religion serves a lot of that role. If you don't know how you got here, where you're going,
right. It's just easy to
watch. There's religion. You don't have to be steeped in mystery and ignorance.
Mm.
But as a scientist, you have to actually learn to love the questions themselves
mm-hmm.
because that's what drives you.
Mm.
That's what seduces you to hang out on that frontier and try to push that envelope.
Have you ever sort of found yourself in the process, either as a graduate student or as a scientist, that like sort of, this one's too hard. This one's too, you're beating your head against the wall. You have to revisit. I
mean, well, you don't know what's too hard. All you know is that you haven't solved the problem yet.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes problems are solved in eureka moments, although much more rarely than mm-hmm. I think the public has led on to believe. Many problems, in fact, Isaac Asimov has famously said, major discoveries don't happen by the scientist saying eureka.
Mm.
Instead, it happens when the scientist said, that's odd.
And that's the beginning of the journey.
That is the beginning of the journey.
Well, this ties into, you talked about Einstein's theory, and there was a place in it for dark matter or dark energy.
Dark energy. That's
but correct. we didn't know for quite a while.
Well, that place was, it has the opposite sign in the equation.
Right. It's,
gravity is an attractive force. This is a repulsive force.
Right.
So that's a little weird. We don't know anything in life that does that.
Right.
And we never measured anything that needed it.
Right.
And so this extra term in Einstein's equations, we would just set it to zero. It was there, but we didn't know what to do with it.
Right.
And we didn't have, there was nothing compelling us to require it.
Mm-hmm.
So we just set it to zero and moved on.
Right.
We would later discover, 1998 evidence, and a Nobel Prize was given for this, discover that, in fact, there is this phenomenon in the large scale universe.
And
we call it dark energy.
But there's still a lot that we don't know in that area.
100% right? of dark energy is unknown to us. We just know that we can measure its influence on the expanding universe.
This is the disconnect for me. I read this and I could. How can you measure something if you don't know?
Oh, you can. Oh, that's the great thing about science. You can measure all kinds of things and not know what the hell it is. You for example, you can measure how hot the sun is, how much energy is coming, without knowing how the sun makes energy. You could measure the positions of stars on the sky without knowing what they're made of or how hot they are.
Right.
You can, in fact, when we first started obtaining spectra of stars, so that you take starlight and pass it through a prism, much the way sunlight comes through a raindrop and you get a rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
Starlight, you can pass through a prism and you get like little mini rainbows in your photograph. And those rainbows tell you what the stars are made of. We knew we were onto something fundamental, but we couldn't read the spectrum in any way that made any sense to anybody.
Right.
But we got data. So thousands and thousands and thousands of spectra were obtained. And only by the 1920s was quantum physics discovered. And then we said, that's how you understand.
Right. Which you described the 20s as a watershed decade.
Yes.
And I'd like you to expand on that because you made a really good point about that, where, you know, people bitch and complain that we're spending money in space and we have all these problems here, blah, blah, blah. And you don't, and that we tend as a culture to look for immediate payoff in things. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand. And
we're talk in about an that, impatient lock.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And talk about that you make a great nexus from the idea of quantum mechanics and our current day existence that I think is utterly fascinating.
You want me to tell you that now? Yeah.
Yes, please.
So 1920s, we basically discovered the operations of the atoms and molecules. A whole branch of physics arose to enable us to understand and predict the behavior of matter on its very smallest scales.
Mm.
Electrons, protons, neutrons would be discovered a little later. And so that's called quantum physics. And whole legions of scientists were working in this field, and Nobel Prizes galore were handed out for these discoveries.
This is years and years and years.
Yeah, and so if you were around at the time, might you be saying, why are these smart people spending their time trying to understand something you can't see? You can't see an atom, you can't even see molecules. Why are you wasting your time? I have glass and I have iron and I have cobalt. I have these materials. I know how they operate under, mm-hmm. I know their macroscopic properties. I build buildings with it. So why should we be investing in this way, you might ask?
Basically, our life is fine. We got
what our life
we
is
need.
Fine.
We got what we
thank
need.
You. It's the roaring 20s. Yeah. Life is fine.
Right, exactly. There's prohibition.
Life is fine.
Right.
Why are you wasting your time in this laboratory and spending hard needed money?
Mm-hmm.
And although the depression hadn't quite mm-hmm. hit in yet. So it would be about 50 years, 40 if you get in the first round of this. But I would say functionally 50 years, it would take 50 into the 1970s before we realized that an entire commercial industry would be founded on our understanding of quantum physics. And it's the information technology revolution, the IT revolution.
Computers.
The creation, storage, and retrieval of information. That's it.
In fact, you...
There is no understanding of that. There is no manipulation of circuits and data without a full understanding of quantum physics. It took 50 years. If you're a CEO, you're saying, I can't invest here because
right.
my quarterly report won't show it. My annual report won't even show it. So right. let's not do it. Yet, if you had invented quantum physics, it's by some measures, a third of the total world's GDP is traceable to information technologies.
Right.
So at no time should you ever be saying, why are you researching this? Ms. Scientist, what does that have to do with my daily life?
Right. And you make this.
I understand the question, but be humble with how you ask it, because
yes.
the answer is profound.
Yes. And the fact, I mean, you say, in fact, that the table of elements wouldn't be the table of elements. Chemists couldn't do their job without quantum.
They wouldn't understand why there was a periodic table of elements.
For
That's correct. We had the periodic table.
Can you explain that in more layman's terms for the listeners?
Yeah, sure. So
and for me.
Mendeleev, a Russian, I think was a chemist, noticed that the properties of these elements that had been discovered, and when he was working, there might have been, I don't know, 70 elements or so, enough to take shape of something if it's to have any shape at all.
Right.
He started lining them up by properties and noticed that if you, some belong horizontal, others go vertical. And as he starts doing this, he notices properties that repeat. So he starts the row over again on the far left and then does it across. Then they repeat again. So it comes back and does it. These are chemical properties. And once you do this, you come up with a chart. You don't know why the properties repeat. You can't explain why this is going on, but you have a chart. This is an example of knowing something without actually fully understanding it. You can still get data on the properties of elements.
This goes back to the point about dark energy. We have zero knowledge of it, but we can
measure. We don't know what it is at all, but we can measure its effects.
Because of science.
Yes, right. Methods and tools of science. So there we are in a periodic table, and quantum mechanics tells us why it's periodic. It tells us. It's a full understanding of why this only has two electrons in its outer shell, and this has four electrons, and this has six, or that has eight. And you can't fit 10. How come there's not 10? Because it can only fit 8. How come this only has 2? You can't fit a third one. There are reasons for this, and it all comes out of quantum physics.
Mm-hmm. And this gets to, for me, the idea of space exploration and, you know, this is the common thing that the average person will say, why we spend the money in space, blah, blah, okay. And you make a point that right now, if you sort of do some relative measurements, where we are in terms of the Hubble telescope, the space station, we're essentially 3/8 of an inch away from the Earth. And your
if
point,
you shrink Earth to a schoolroom globe.
Right, okay. So your point is...
The orbits of the space station and the like.
Yeah. There's all of that other space out there that we need to be going to. We spend half a penny per taxpayer dollars, which you made a point. And you've said, which I think is fascinating, I think I know what you're getting, I'm saying, go into space so that you can get rich, not because it's a beautiful thing. And I think what you're saying is money drives this world, this economy. Whatever the motivation is to get up there, let's get up there.
Yeah, I've lost the expectation that people would spend scads of money to go into space just because it's beautiful. In my old age, I've become cynical. But I do know people would do it for money, particularly in a free capitalist society. But it's one thing to go into space so that you can make money. It's a separate thing, a related thing, that if the government goes into space in a way that stimulates curiosity in the electorate, so that the electorate then becomes comfortable with discovery, comfortable with investments in science, because innovations in science and technology, the engines of tomorrow's economy. And I think a bold, audacious, bodacious space program will help transform a sleepy country into an innovation nation.
You think, but the economic growth that you talk about and you've talked about that can come from that is slow in coming. I mean, that becomes the problem.
There'd be a time delay. Yeah. But fortunately, the government generally doesn't have to file quarterly reports,
right,
the way corporations do. So
you don't file taxes, right? You just do whatever you want. Right? You're connected.
I'm a citizen of the cosmos. So
that would be nice.
I told that to the IRS. They didn't buy it. Right? They didn't buy it.
You're a very smart man. You would think they would just listen to you and just leave it alone, right?
And it's not about spinoffs. It's about changing a culture. What happens if the hurricane comes? Do you run away from it, or do you say, "How can I control the hurricane?" What is your mindset?
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a country that's solving problems and taking names, you respond differently to forces that operate around you. You respond in ways that can create a brand new tomorrow.
So that brand new tomorrow, like what is happening now in space and space experimentation and research and innovation that we might see as a tangible sort of benefit in terms of economic growth, stimulation in this country or in the world down the road?
On a large scale, I don't see it. I don't see anything.
Why? Because there's not enough.
We're not advancing a space frontier. We're just not.
Yeah.
The only, you know, when I was younger, I remembered reading when I was very young. Oh, we now have the fastest train or the fastest plane or the tallest building or the deepest tunnel or the longest bridge. And for a while there, I said, this sounds like a peeing contest. You know, yeah. America has the longest. It's like, who gives a fuck? Does it get you to where you're going?
Yeah.
We're fine. But then I realized, first, yes, it is a peeing contest. However, but that's not my point.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, nothing wrong with that. You got to sometimes, you know.
You got to just pull it out and see what's fun.
Yeah, right.
That was a science paper that I wrote years ago. No, I.
But the effect that it has is if you're going to do something that's never been done before, make a longer bridge, taller building that's never been done before, you're pushing a frontier.
A scientific frontier.
A technological frontier. Mm-hmm. Any kind of frontier. You have to do what's never been done before. Only then do you extend a frontier.
Right.
Artists extend frontiers.
Right.
That's the only way art ever moves anywhere.
Exactly.
If you don't extend a frontier, you're stuck in some previous art form.
Right.
Right? So this is not unique to science. But it will matter economically. Because if you extend a frontier, you have to innovate to do so. You have to invent. You have to have patents. And out of that regime, between whatever was the last accomplishment and the leapfrogging you did beyond it, in that zone is the future. It's future economies, future wealth, future health, future security.
But here's the issue with that, and I'll take the other side for a minute. So you can then understand why the average person who's not as forward-thinking, and frankly, as brilliant as you and others in your field might be, if they can't see that you live for that zone of the unknown, that's your whole life, right? The average person's like, well, I don't see it. So what's the point? And I got to take a bus to go to work. Give me some money so I can buy a car, right? Now, I'm not justifying that. I agree with you, but that's that. So this gets back to what I initially was going to talk about with you initially, which is you making science relatable to the average person. Joe Patterson said, Tyson meets people where they are rather than seeking to raise them to where he is. It's kind of a combination of Carl Sagan and Mr. Rogers, which I don't see the sweater, so I'm not buying that. And
but you have slippers on the side.
You have to have slippers, and
I'm not a fan of orange, right?
And do you like to work with puppets? Because I have puppets.
Right. Plus, I think he was colorblind. Maybe that's why the orange didn't bother him.
Is that
the
right?
Sweater. Yeah, he's actually colorblind. And the king was colorblind. They made the king character.
Is that right?
In the little train set or whatever the thing was.
Oh, just so that kids would understand.
Yeah, yeah. Puts it in play.
But you see what I'm saying there? If you make this all sort of comes together for me in the sense of sort of we're talking about something that's a very essential in the long term to our culture, to our race, to humanity, to the world. And how do we make that connection better for the average person, make that nexus work so that they see the benefits.
There's a lot of science where you can talk about their benefits. And if that stimulates people, all the more. But you cannot base a scientific research program on the requirement that the very question that gets posed directly impacts the quality of life on Earth. You can't do that. Yeah. If you look at my physics professor in college who studied atomic nuclei, and discovered a new phenomenon in the universe that he discovered how nuclei of atoms can respond to radiation, essentially. And different atoms respond different ways. So he discovered something called nuclear magnetic resonance. And he was basically an astrophysicist. He was my physics professor in college. He would win the Nobel Prize for that. Later on, a medical technologist said, hey, if you can distinguish atomic nuclei with this method, I can make a machine, put you in the machine, and image your soft tissue. Thus was born the magnetic resonance imager, the MRI. It is based on a principle of physics discovered by a physicist who had no interest in medicine. And of course, there was a time delay. And the MRI is arguably the most potent tool in the medical doctor's arsenal to diagnose your condition without cutting you open. So with examples such as that, I don't think it's hard for someone to embrace the idea that an investment may take 5 or even 10 years to return. Mm. But we're talking about a small percentage of the total federal budget. Surely put other money for things that are directly related to quality of life.
Yeah.
But just don't go to the 1% and say, oh, I need that to improve my quality of life here, when you already have 99% to work with, when that's the 1% or the 1.5% or the 2% that's going to build an entire future for us and completely transform how we live.
Right. How do you feel about this private enterprise of going into space, space trips for?
Yeah, it's I think it's been oversold.
In what sense?
No, I didn't say that right. I think it's the promise that it holds for our future has been oversold. So first of all, private enterprise should have been doing this decades ago.
Why?
Why not? No reason for NASA to do something routine. You have NASA to do things that have never been done before. It knows how to get to Earth orbit. It knows how to haul cargo back and forth. Get private enterprise to do that.
Right.
They'll do it more efficiently, at low risk, because the investments have already been made on how to make it safe. This is the value of a government doing something first.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need the immediate business model to have to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
They just need the long-term model. So SpaceX was carrying cargo back and forth to the space station. Should have been happening decades ago. In the same way the post office doesn't fly its own airplanes. They rent space in the belly of Delta Airlines or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
Delta carries the mail. They pick it up on the other end. They don't have to maintain a fleet. They don't have to do anything. So when you consider that, private enterprise is not going to lead us into space.
Right.
There's no business model leading space. Mm-hmm. There is a business model doing what has been established as routine activities. You can make a whole... base whole companies on that.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is always, is NASA out of business and now it's really space private enterprise? No. Private enterprise could go to Mars, but it would be a one-off. There's no business model to do it first. You know, you're a venture capitalist and you ask me, I say, I want to go to Mars. You say, well, what will it cost? I don't know, but a lot. Is it dangerous? Yes. People probably die. What's my return on investment? I don't know yet. You're in the next room talking to somebody else.
Yeah.
So governments can take those risks. They have in the past.
Yeah. And so you think in the long term, there'll be some positive benefits of this sort of private enterprise going up and beyond
if it helps
sort
us
of joyride
access,
for rich people beyond
well,
that.
Well, yeah, you'd want, if you want to make it a business model and have tourist jaunts to the moon, yeah, you'd have to bring down the price.
Yeah.
Some more.
Yeah. It's your background, very quickly, for people who don't know, you're obviously the director of the Hayden Planetarium here at the Museum of Natural History, and grew up in New York City, went to public school here.
Born and raised.
You were 9.
K-12 public school.
There you go. Uh-huh. And you were 9, and you got hooked on the world of astronomy by coming to the Hayden Planetarium.
Yep.
And it opened up your eyes, and...
I think the universe chose me, actually.
You know, I've read that quote, and I know your issue or where you stand regarding, or I think I do, regarding God, religion, and science. I think you call yourself an agnostic. But there's something very spiritual when you say it chose you. Is there some spirituality in you or are you a cynic to that and the idea of mysticism and a pure? Because when I've read that, that showed a different side to you to me than what I expected.
So let's back up for a minute. So the only reason why I say I'm agnostic is because if I had to pick a word, I guess that's what the word would be, but I'd rather not be attached to any such word at all.
Right.
If you have questions, you ask me and I'll answer you.
Right.
And if based on those answers you want to label me one thing or another, then go ahead.
Right.
But I'm not going to label myself.
Okay.
Because that's not how I think of myself. I have thoughts, I have ideas, I have perspectives, and...
You're not interested in putting yourself in a particular box.
Right, because it is a box. When you say you are this or that, you are presuming that the portfolio of concepts associated with that word or that group also applies to you. Now, maybe they do for me, but I just don't think of myself that way.
And well, you actually analogize that there's no such thing as non-golfers, right? Oh, yes. Right? Which they're really clever.
No, there's no community of non-golfers.
Right.
So the idea
that get together and non-golf. Right?
Non-golf.
Hey, what are you doing? We're going to non-golf.
Well, yeah, come on over. We're non-golfing today. So to have a community of atheists, people who don't believe in God.
Right.
It's not what I do.
Yeah, just don't believe in him and move on with your
life. No,
but don't make a cause.
No, so I don't even. Right. Plus, I don't tell people what my beliefs are.
Right.
I just don't, because I don't care at all if you agree with my beliefs. Mm-hmm. There's nothing less important to me in the world.
Have you always been like that?
Well, I've come to learn that I just don't care. So I don't care that you vote for who I vote for.
Okay.
Right. That's a belief. Yeah. It's an opinion.
Yeah.
Right. I do not care if anyone in this world shares my opinions on anything. I'm an educator. It's my task to get you to think as deeply as you can, as factually as you can, about decisions you might make. And you learn how to think about information and data. Then I walk away to vote for the hell you want. Call yourself who you want. Yeah. So this is the thing about the agnostic. I don't. The atheist community wants to claim me, and then I list things that I do that no atheist would do, and
such as,
I don't say no atheist. I would say it's just less common.
For example, like
I don't think an atheist would post a tweet as I did this past Christmas. This past Easter, I was visiting my sister who has rabbits,
mm-hmm.
and her rabbit Ozzy is this huge rabbit. It looks like, I don't know, genetically altered or something. I don't know what it is. I've never seen a rabbit this large.
Like the giant rabbit in the Holy Grail?
It's like, no, that was a little rabbit that cut people's throats because it could fly, right? No, that was a smaller rabbit.
Right.
And it had to be small and cute.
Right.
That made it all the more scary pull that off.
Yeah.
So Monty Python and the Holy Grail,
yes.
For those who missed it.
Yes.
So I photographed myself with the rabbit, and I said, to all, Ozzy and I wish all Christians and rabbit lovers a happy Easter. That was a tweet
this
past year.
Right.
And I'm holding the rabbit, barely, you know, trying to selfie me with the rabbit. I don't know atheists who would do that.
Right.
Right? I don't.
Do you live in
So therefore, if you want to call me an atheist,
right.
because I'm not touting up belief systems that involve a deity.
Right.
And then you're going to wonder, don't tell me later, oh, I thought you were an atheist. Why did you post that?
Right.
Well, get out of my face. Then it's not about the label.
Because then it starts, the tail wags the dog, and it starts dictating what you want to, what you can and what you think you shouldn't say, because my atheist friends are brethren aren't going to. Right.
Precisely. And that's why I there's a little bit of distance between me and the labeling. So now about spirituality, your spirit is actually your breath. If you look at the original Latin, I guess,
mm-hmm.
of it, and expire is, you know, your breath leaves you and you die, for example. So your spirit is now, it is broadly been thought of as either your soul or in animists, the community of animists, which would include, I think, most Native Americans, where there's a spirit of the brook and of the tree and of the wind, where the animists, where animate and inanimate objects are infused with spirits. Okay. So
you know that or believe that?
No. I'm citing how people use the word spirit.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So for me, when I say spiritual, I'm referring to a feeling that you would have that connects you to the universe in a way that it may defy simple vocabulary. So here we think about the universe as an intellectual playground, which it surely is. But the moment you learn something that touches an emotion rather than just something intellectual, I would call that a spiritual encounter with the universe.
And that is the exact encounter I had when Jay Leno did my first joke on The Tonight Show for $50.
Can you tell me what that joke was?
It was.
How long ago was it?
It was a dozen years ago. I was working these huge M&A deals, working all night, slaving away. I went to a private function, gave him my joke, said, you can have them. He called me the next day, said, I'm going to do one of your jokes on The Tonight Show. And it was about this old house on
the show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how it didn't reflect reality at all because, you know, the contractor's always under budget, clean shaven, polite, does extra work. But in real life, you know, he's drunk, hitting on your wife, you know, and $40,000 over budget, did really well. And it, middle class Italian kid from Rhode Island, didn't come from any money.
It was surreal.
And I was sitting in money at this point. Mm-hmm. I literally owned an apartment across the street on 79th Street from here. Mm-hmm. Doorman bill, like I had made it. My father put floors in for a living. I had made it. And it, I'm talking about it now and I got goosebumps. It just, I can't explain
your
it.
Your hair standing up on your arm there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think what happened was, probably what happened to you when you were nine, I think I created something, and I don't want to make this about me, please, but I think I created something out of thin air and somebody reacted to it. And it moved me in a way that advising people on corporate merger deals couldn't. So I understand that mm-hmm. phrase that you use. I was just fascinated that it would come from you, but I get it. I totally get it.
Yeah, I look up and there's the splendor and majesty of the universe. And I, as far as I can tell, these are similar vocabulary words to people who have religious experiences. They're transcended yeah. in some way. And so the universe does that for me daily.
Yeah.
But I can do that without assigning gods to it, right? With properties and laws and rules. I mean, it's spirituality, I think, is something that sits apart from scripture, if you will. Scripture might be the formal manifestation of a community right. in the face of spirituality. But spirituality taken on its own, you can have a spiritual connection with your children that are just born or possibly even with your pets. If you, you know, people...
Now, trust me, my wife does.
The one
we have our cat's ashes on our...
No, you don't.
And she said...
No.
On our bookcase. And she says, well, what should we do with them? And I said, well...
See, I thought you were starting a stand-up routine.
No,
you
know? No, I would never do that here.
My wife, take my wife. Yeah, no, really, take my wife. She's got cat's ashes on the thing. She kicks me out of the house, but keeps the cat's ashes.
I get no respect. That cat gets wet. So she said, what should we do with them? And I said, well, I think it would be good karma if we took his ashes and threw them in the litter box. It would sort of be a complete...
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Yes, exactly.
Poop
and
to poop.
And she proceeded to slap me. She goes, you're being so mean.
That's hilarious.
So
that's
she
a great idea.
She believes that she can look at my dog, our dog, and see that its belly's full and probably needs to poop. That's okay. I don't even know why I'm telling you this right now.
That's TMI right there. I think
a brilliant mind that I'm talking about dog poop. But she's a very spiritual person and mm-hmm. believes in sort of karma and all of that stuff.
Well, so like I said, you can be spiritual without having to believe in something. That's right. My point. To believe in something implies that you think something is true in the absence of evidence. Mm. That's what faith means.
Right.
There's no evidence. Not in any traditional scientific sense of evidence, yet you believe in it nonetheless. Right. And I'm saying, if I feel the universe in me, I'm feeling the universe. But I don't have, am I believing something?
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying I'm reacting to the universe emotionally.
So
it does not require that I believe anything.
I totally get it. So mm-hmm. when you're nine and you see that, what is the word or phrase you're like, why? What is that? How does that happen?
Yeah, questions.
What was at nine? That's
yeah, I love the questions. Yeah, you got to love the questions.
But at nine, I was like, I want Jell-O. Like I was like,
I also wanted Jell-O. I also wanted Jell-O. And between 9 and 11, I would, you know, I'd buy stars, glow in the dark stars, and find star maps and put them on the ceiling so that I can go to sleep. As an urban kid, that's the best you can do.
Yeah, exactly.
Put the stick on stars on the right.
And usually you look up and it's a police helicopter.
Right. And I get a flashlight to just re-energize the stars because they only have the energy from the light that you shine on them because they're not radioactive.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to keep you much longer, but I got to
Yeah, so my assistant walked by.
Real quick thing here. I want to end on what I consider to be a noble cause, which is you are sort of the voice to sort of bring the complexity of science to the average person and make it relatable. And I want to just, you talked about tweeting and you, on Super Bowl day. These are in one day.
At the time of this recording, that's only days ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Well, these are all tweets on this day. And I'm not even reading all the tweets. Okay. A 50-yard field goal in the University of Phoenix Stadium deflects 1/3 of an inch to the right due to Earth's rotation. Okay. Now, let me just read a couple more. Examples of elastic collision: two bouncy balls, two football helmets, an elastic collision, two pillows, two marshmallows.
Well, that's because in a previous tweet, I think you're reading them in reverse time order. Probably. In a previous tweet,
right, Don't correct me. See, that's where you get annoying. To be honest with you.
No, the educational part of this is I had a previous tweet that mentioned elastic and inelastic collisions.
Okay.
And in case you didn't know what those were, the next tweet defined elastic and inelastic.
Okay, just one more. Just an FYI, a 250-pound football player running 50 miles an hour has more kinetic energy than a bullet from an AK-47 rifle. That is so true. Utterly fascinating to me. I didn't know any of that. I didn't know, thanks to you now in doing the research, that honeymoon comes from the June moon, which is the shade of amber. And that's
because it's really low in the sky.
Okay. And I'm going to grab you and shake you a little bit. Why are there so many, dang it, nerd scientists and aren't cool guys?
Did you actually say
like,
God dang it?
Yeah, sorry. I don't know why. It's my own podcast. God damn it. Okay. Then you're an agnostic. I can't even offend you. But you know what I mean? Like this is, I only read a few of the tweets you put out. And this is clearly, you did Cosmos. Great.
Okay, so here's the thing. Here's the difference. The difference is, this is not science made simple. This is science intersecting pop culture. And there's science everywhere in pop culture.
But you're using this as
a brilliant
vehicle.
But my colleagues don't get it. My field and science in general, if you are a professional scientist, you don't get street cred. You don't get tenure credentials by learning pop culture. It's a mark against you.
But this is why you said that when you were asked at your grammar school to give a commencement address, you said, I am who I am in spite of school, not because of it.
What went on in that elementary school?
Let me talk to the teachers instead. And I related to that because the only thing I remember for science, I sort of remember how to make the battery. Remember, we all had to make a battery. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Yeah.
And I'm not a brilliant kid, but I'm not a dumb kid. And I wish I had known stuff like this because my son looked towards baseball. We talk, why does a baseball curve when you throw it? Yeah, right?
So there's physics and all of that. And I take occasions that I know everyone is engaged in the Super Bowl. Everyone's watching the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Even if you don't like the Super Bowl, you're watching the Super Bowl. So why not tweet about the physics of the Super Bowl? And so those I had to calculate, make sure that I got the right numbers, 1/3 of an inch to the right. By the way, if the Phoenix Stadium were exactly north-south, it would be almost 1/2 inch. To the right, but it was tipped from north south
because of the magnetic pole.
No. So it's just the effect of this deflection is maximum if you're moving either due south or due north.
And that's all.
But the stadium is not oriented exactly due south, and a field goal would be going along the length of the stadium, obviously, because you're kicking a field goal. So I find these cues, and this is what my podcast does, Star Talk, which is now on Sirius XM Radio and National Geographic just picked up 10 episodes of it. They want to put it on the channel.
Television show?
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, you're doing Sirius XM. One of my buddies, John Fugelsang, and Pete Dominic also have shows on that. It's Insight, right?
Yes. Yeah, Insight. Yeah, new channel.
Yeah.
And thanks, Channel 121, if anyone's interested.
Yeah. And they can go to StarTalk.com to get all your podcasts.
Yeah, no, StarTalk.radio.net. And all the past episodes are really great. But in there, my co-host is a professional stand-up comedian. Because I respect what you guys do deeply.
Yeah. Who is that?
Well, we have a stable of comedians that we draw from. Eugene Merman is among them.
Oh, yeah. And you talk about Chuck this Nice. Stuff. Yeah, you talk.
And so they provide some needed levity. Well, I think the universe is hilarious, but if I have a comedian next to me, I don't have to go there because they will.
Yeah.
And I can focus more a little bit on, and I can toss them some softballs, you know. Good comedians will just pick up on it.
Yeah.
And the subject at hand gets the fun pop culture treatment that I think hasn't really been an activity of the past.
Well, you're really great at it. I know we got to let you go. I could talk to you forever, but thank you. Star Talk on Sirius XM and StarTalkRadio.net.
Yes. And it's on National Geographic.
Yeah.
Picked up some shows this spring. And it's a get to know you number. It's like 10 shows, you know.
is going to work. Have you started to shoot them?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, we're shooting tonight even.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. We're pre-taping for airing, and they'll premiere in April.
And what's the, are you going to be sort of out in the field doing things? Are you in a studio? Like what's
No, they're basically filming the podcast. So it was overplayed when the press got a hold of the announcement.
Yeah.
Because it is actually the very first science talk show ever, mm-hmm. it turns out. But, and it's the very first talk show for National Geographic Channel. And when the press release hit the blogosphere, oh, Tyson is joining the nighttime talk show lineup. It's like, no, first of all,
Having a band?
No, right. That's what I'm saying. No, it's just my podcast and they're filming the podcast,
all right.
Basically, but with some window dressing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. It's the podcast.
Right. That's and you'll have guests come in and all of that.
It's the podcast. Yeah. Everything the podcast was is this is going to be. And so, and it's only one night a week. So, you know, Jimmy Fallon, it's fine. I'm not going to lure the roots away from Jimmy Fallon, all right?
You're going to start doing games where you throw water in people's faces and stuff like that. Well, right. Listen, thank you very much for your time. This has been terrific.
Okay, and, yeah, good luck with that.
We will post this very shortly. I'll let you know when.
And I hope, so you know, if you're a comedian and you appreciate good jokes, I'll tell you a joke from a science comedian friend of mine.
Yes.
Brian Mallow. Okay.
Yes.
Did you read about the Higgs boson? Do you know about the Higgs boson?
No.
It's the particle that was discovered in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
Nobel Prize has already been given for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a particle whose field grants mass to other particles that pass through it. So it's an awesome particle. In fact, there's a book written called The God Particle.
Yeah.
All about that particle. Because if you were going to be a particle, that's the...
How does one particle pass through another? Can you give me an example?
No, I have a particle and there's a field that emanates from me.
Okay.
And you are another particle entering that field. Your interaction with my field defines how much mass you carry. So it's a very powerful particle.
Like a man compared to a woman.
What do you mean?
I'm just joking.
No, it establishes your mass. That's the point.
Right.
So it was discovered in Switzerland at the Large Hadron Collider. So you have to know all of that.
Okay.
For this joke to work.
All right. Okay.
Okay. Higgs boson walks into a church. By the way, I tested this with a Jesuit priest. So we're cool on this. Right?
I went to a Jesuit college.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I got top.
You're good.
Top support on this one. What college did you go to?
Providence College.
Providence College. Yeah. Okay. So, Higgs boson walks into a church. The priest said, I'm sorry, but Higgs bosons aren't allowed. And the Higgs boson said, but without me, you can't have mass.
Nice.
Well, it's good. It's quick. Good. It's clean. It's sharp.
You could kids' birthday party.
Yeah, it's good. It
you
works.
Just, I think.
It's nerdy.
Right, exactly. You're just going to need a slideshow to explain the setup. Jay Leno said to me once, and one of my jokes, he goes, what do you do for a living? I go, I'm a lawyer. He goes, I knew it. I go, why? He goes, your setups are way too long. He said, I was writing like, he goes, you don't need to tell me when to make a funny face. I was putting like stage direction and make funny face here. But, but are you a frustrated entertainer in a previous life, you think?
No. I just highly respect what people do
when
they are entertaining.
Yeah.
And if I give a talk and it's a good talk, people might come up to me and say, oh, you gave a great talk. And I say, thank you. But there's two categories of people that don't say that to me. They say something else. Comedians and teachers say, you are working hard up there.
I saw you on...
That's the compliment.
Yeah. I saw you on Bill Maher a few months ago, and that was a great appearance, and I'll say performance, too, because you were... You know, juggling between him and you got an audience.
There's a whole dynamic, there's a whole audience that I'm flanked by left and right.
Right.
And.
But you're a great communicator, and that's what's lacking in education.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And to the extent that it works, I'm happy to keep doing it.
No, it's working. Yeah. So, anyway, again, thank you very much.
Off.
You're the best.
All right.
Thank you. All right. More jokes to come from Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Thanks, everybody.